asked to talk about Yama Niyama. Everybody knows what that is. Everybody knows yoga, right?
He doesn't know what it means.
Yeah, okay. Yoga means to link up ultimately with the Supreme Being, but nowadays when everybody hears yoga, they just think about exercise. Which is, yoga is an eightfold system. So there's yama and niyama. Those mean things you should do and things you shouldn't do. Then there's asana. So that asana means sitting or postures, and that's what's called hatha yoga usually. And that's what people think yoga is. Then comes pranayama. Some yoga teachers, they teach pranayama, breathing. And then what comes next? Dharana, meditation, concentration of the mind, and then finally complete absorption in spiritual understanding. So without that foundation of yama and niyama, you can't really make the advancement. You might get the exercises and become a little more healthy, stronger, or have a bright face, or whatever you can get. But the yama and niyama, that's ethical, it has to be there. And so it's many yoga teachers talk about this, and it's very ancient, and every culture has ethics, right? They have rules, things you should do, things you shouldn't do. And so the yamas are what you shouldn't do. And the first one is ahimsa. You know that word? Ahimsa? Common word? Non-violence, yeah. Himsa means violence. Ahimsa means non-violence. So like Gandhi, he stressed on that. And all spiritual leaders, and most people, they say they want non-violence. They mean against themselves or against their religion or against their color or against their country or whatever. Most people are not very concerned about violence against the animals or the environment, you know, the trees. There's a lot of violence going on. And ahimsa means even the thinking nasty thoughts or something. That's also violent. Thoughts have some power. So, that's ahimsa is the first one. Controlling oneself, you know. Disciplining the body. So it says lying and untruthfulness, that's the second one. Shouldn't tell lies. Him says not only not killing, but not harming any other living entities. Now that we can't even breathe or eat or walk or anything without harming some living entities. That's why one should be spiritually situated, but at least minimize, not purposely just trying to annihilate any kind of living entities. When you injure others, you injure yourself also. Buddha stressed on that. You know. There's a reaction for everything you do, so to have ahimsa, one must be patient, forgiving, you have to put up with insults, you have to put up with, you have to be tolerant, forgiving. One of my friends defined it is to give up trying to have a better past. Stop trying to improve your past. Let it go. Because you can't change it. So if someone is just, you know, say someone hurt us, but, you know, that happens. We've been hurt by many different living entities in our life. So if we hold a grudge, we're just thinking how to get back or even just thinking that person's so bad all the time, then we just suffer. It doesn't hurt them at all. But we suffer, you know, by carrying that around. So one should be forgiving. It's just part of nonviolence. And what's next? Satyam is truthfulness. Satyam Param Dharma. Gandhi stressed on that also. Truthfulness is the highest dharma, the highest religion. Religion is not, you know, Jewish or Orthodox or what else do we have in the world now? So many different religions. You know, so-called religion. But that's not a religion, that's just a group, just a society. Religion is principles. So the highest principle is truthfulness. One should speak the truth, but nicely, carefully. And there are exceptions. Violence is sometimes necessary. Right? Say some terrorist just comes in the shopping mall and starts shooting everybody. So the police, you know, they can shoot him, and that violence is good because it saved the lives of so many other people. Or if a wild tiger in the mountains comes in the village and he's, you know, killing children and old men, then if somebody kills that tiger, then that violence is okay. But that's all, everything is not, that doesn't mean that it's okay all the time, but only in special circumstances. And in the ancient Shastras of Scripture, there's so many, everything has its exception, but it has to be in a certain way. Not that you just, whenever you feel like it, you can be violent. Well, I just felt like being violent. I didn't like him. Or, you know, I don't like cows, so I kill all the cows. Right? Some people try to say that cows are so bad, they're creating greenhouse gas by their belching or something. Trying to encourage people, you know, dairy products are so bad, so you just kill them, that's what they're for. But that kind of violence is making a lot of trouble. So truthfulness also, we should tell the truth, but sometimes, no. There's a story Krishna tells. There was one very simple man, he lived in the forest, and he decided that he would always tell the truth. And that would be his, you know, his vow. So he was alone most of the time, but one day a man very fearfully ran past him and ran off in the forest. And then a little while later, a group of dacoits, they call them, they're thieves, you know, they were chasing after him with weapons. And they asked this man, which way did he go? So he thought, I have to always tell the truth. So he said, you know, he went that way. He took that trail. So they caught him and they killed him. So that means that the guy who told the truth in that condition, he gets implicated in the murder. So sometimes you have to be discriminating. To protect life, there's different reasons why you can not exactly tell the truth, but basically one has to be truthful. The absolute truth means to talk about the Krishna, the Supreme Being. That's always true. So that's one way to avoid, you know, problems. In the mature world, what's true for you might not be true for me. What's true for, you know, the truth changes. What's true in the material world, it's true today, not tomorrow. But this means the higher levels. And you'll see that if you know the Ten Commandments in the Bible, these are similar. There's ten of them also. Asteya is another Sanskrit word. That means non-stealing. No stealing, no taking things that don't belong to you. That means you have to root out unwanted desires, you know, because lust. When someone is lusty, they want something, then, you know, eventually they, you know, rob, steal, kill somebody just to get it. Gotta have it. So stealing is very bad. It's condemned in any culture. It's a crime anywhere. different. Just take someone else's property. But it's a common thing now, and sometimes it's done by legal tactics, sometimes by violent tactics, sometimes by tricks. In Africa, you see many houses that have they're half built, you know, and the painted on the wall says, "This is not for sale." Because people see it's just like there and nobody's around. So they write up some false papers and sell it to somebody. And then, you know, if you want to buy something there, you have to, it takes a long time to search if the person selling it really owns it. You have to go way back. India, same thing. As soon as you try to buy something, three or four people come to say it's theirs. But there's different ways people steal. People will steal another person's wife. They steal their money. They steal their business. You know, there's so much dishonesty this age. Kali, the last thing that's still standing in Kali Yuga is truthfulness, but it's being, you know, chopped away quite fast. So many people think nothing of telling lies. They think that to be successful in business, you have to lie. You know, cheating on the wife or the husband is not unknown, and they'll always lie about it. So no stealing. And if we're not taking up these things and working on it, then a spiritual advancement's not possible. And it also says if you're established in this not stealing completely, 100%, then you'll become very wealthy somehow. That's also, if you serve Dharma, then Dharma serves you as karma. But people in this age think if you're honest, you'll just be cheated and you won't have anything. Right? Isn't it? Many people think, not everybody, but many, many people think. There are also many honest businessmen that do very well. And they have to watch out. You know, they can't be simpletons. Then the cheaters will come. Then there's Brahmacharya. We see this being promoted now more and more in Africa. That means continence, controlling sensual pleasure, sex, because they have so much AIDS there in Africa. So the government is starting to put up signboards, control yourself, you know, stick with your wife, don't rush into premarital sex and, you know, all those kind of things to try to prevent AIDS. They could come up with so much stronger things than they do. I was saying we should make one that says sex pleasure is a few minutes, but AIDS lasts until you die. It's a long time, and it just gets worse and worse all the time. The sex pleasure is very short, and it's not ever what it's cracked up to be, and then there's chances of all these other things. But people think, well, it won't happen to me, but even if that doesn't happen, it's a costly thing in many, many ways, because it makes one very attached to the body, and thinking that the body is a great source of pleasure, that makes it very hard to actually meditate on the soul, on the real person, on the life force that's within the body. The higher pleasures, much higher pleasures are there. That's why yogis and they can do without all these things, because they're getting a higher pleasure. They're not like biting their tongue and just, I can't do it, you know, my religion won't let me do this, you know, it's not that at all. They're enjoying so much pleasure they don't want to come down. And it says here there's certain asanas that can help, which is a headstand and a shoulder stand, pranayama and japa. Japa means chanting names of God, like you're just doing. There's other asanas too that specifically help one to be peaceful, so you can concentrate on higher things. That's one that's quite revolutionary in this age of Kali. But everyone knows intrinsically that there's something better. Everybody, spends a lot of time remembering how happy they were when they were small children, or watching, taking such great pleasure to see how happy small children are, right? They don't have any sex desire. They're not bothered by that. One girl I know, she was teaching some boys, they were not quite teenage, maybe 11, 12 years old. And she was teaching school, ordinary school, and three or four boys, and they were really good, they were really learning, and they were really happy. And then one girl came in the class, and then they started, you know, only competing to get the attention of the girl, and then she couldn't teach them anymore, you know. So, like, some schools still separate, because it used to be, they always did that, that, you know, mind will be more peaceful. So these are things. And then there's upadigraha, freedom from possessiveness and covetousness beyond what you need. I had one picture that showed, you know, you have to, what you want and then what you need, you know, usually. But if someone makes a big list of all the things they want, then you start to look over that list. What you really want, when you boil it all down, you just want to be happy. And we think that, you know, some people have a long list of very big and costly things that will make them happy, and other people, you know, they just, some little thing, you know, just to get a place to sleep for the night or something, to find a good cardboard box or something for the night, that's all they think about, then they'll be happy. But real happiness, of course, is not dependent on external circumstances, not dependent on the things you have. Did they have yuppies in Greece?
Yeah.
I saw the yuppie license plate holder. It said, he who dies with the most things, you know,
wins.
But then one said, he still dies. You know, and you had to have the right watch and the right, everything had to be just right. And then you're supposed to be happy. So you work really hard. You have no time for even meeting with your wife, if you have one. They have a big house, but they never get the chance to go home. And so many things. So wanting things that you don't really need. I read in the internet, you know, because America now, so many people lost their job, their income went way down. You know, their stocks and bonds are worth 10% of what they were before. So the money coming in is way down. So people are going through their house and, you know, selling off like so many things that they just bought when they had money and they never used. You know, they're putting them up on the internet or putting a yard sale or something, and cutting back on, you know, they don't go for Starbucks in the morning. And they, you know, many, many things that, and they're finding that they're much happier getting rid of everything. You know, get rid of their iPhone and get rid of their BlackBerry and get rid of so many things, and their life becomes much more peaceful. Generally, just seeing all the advertising and thinking, I gotta have that, you gotta have this. Freedom. Right? Freedom to get whatever you want. That's what the mistaken idea of freedom. I saw the perfect example of that in the airport yesterday. It was at Marlboro, you know? Marlboro. So it was a huge one, all the way across the whole hallway, up high. And it had, you know, the Marlboro packs, and it had the beautiful desert or something. Then it said, freedom to enjoy Marlboro. That's their idea of freedom. You can buy whatever cigarette you want. You can get whatever kind of motorcycle you want. You can, real freedom. You know, people think about a lot of money, then I'll be free. But real freedom is to be free from the pushing of all these needs, the so-called needs, these wants, not controlled by them. Not thinking that I have to get a certain haircut, or I have to get a certain dress, or I have to have a certain car, or nobody will like me. You know, they're actually brainwashing people like that. It's mind control. So, that's the next one. Not coveting other people's things. You know, I think the Ten Commandments says one should not covet one's neighbor's wife, or did it just say property? Nobody even knows the Ten Commandments.
Yes, yes, it's right.
I think in what?
It's right, you're right.
The wife?
Yes, yes, it's about the wife.
Well, that's a good one, but nowadays it's considered well. Wife swapping, right? Right? It's you know, okay. You need a little variety. But it's not very good practice. Then there's the niyamas. So one can progress very quickly on the spiritual path by... These are regulated principles of freedom, real freedom. When we get a higher taste, so we're not pushed around by all these desires that pop into the body and mind, and they come and go really fast. So they have what they call impulse shopping, and right? What do they call it? Compulsive. What's that? They got a psychological. Huh?
Chocoholic?
Yeah, chocoholic.
Or
they call obsessive compulsive. You know, so it could be for any type of thing. You know, some people are just obsessive compulsive shoppers. So another thing, like I said, a lot of people now in America, these people that, and maybe here also, that aren't making so much money, they make a very careful shopping list of what they actually need before they go to the market. Then they go like this, and they just get what they need and they leave. They don't stop and look at anything or listen to, hey, you know, Carrefour shoppers, get over here, we got a big sale over in the tire department, you know, right? They announce like that all the time. Get over to this department right away, we got a big sale on, you couldn't really win over here. So some of them don't even go to the market, they just go on the internet and order things or call up, so they don't get distracted. Whereas before they thought, you know, okay, yeah, maybe I can use that, maybe. And they have a whole house full of things they don't need. In America, it's a very big business, these storage sheds, right? So people have so much stuff, they rent another place just to keep it. And they just lock it up, and that's it, you know, and they die, and then there's somebody selling it. My mother had my toys from when I was a little kid. Don't want to throw anything in. So then there's niyama. Niyama is means things you should do. So it's not all negative. So just like if you're driving the car, there are rules that you shouldn't do certain things. Even if you have a license, right? It doesn't mean that you can drive on the footpath, or you can go as fast as you want, or you can drive through all the red lights or anything. Just because you have a license to drive, you have to know the rules of the road before you can get the license. Usually, you have to pass a test only about the rules before they let you even take the test to see if you can drive or not. Because someone might be able to drive, but they don't know any rules. They used to, in Japan, it was very strange. Because for a Japanese person to get a driver's license, it's like torture. They have to spend thousands of dollars and go to driving school. And they always flunk the test like 3 or 4 times, and they say, you stupid, you don't know how to drive. You need another $1,000 course. And I was teaching one of our girls, and they weren't even teaching her to drive hardly, you know. And then I taught her, and she passed the test on the first time. The driver, the teacher almost fainted. So it never happened before. Anyway, but for an American, if you showed your American driver's license, they'd just give you a Japanese driver's license without a test. But you don't know what any of the signs mean, because they're all in Japanese. They drive on the other side of the road, you know, everything. But they just give you a license. Now they don't do that anymore. But they didn't give you a book to tell you, like, you know, what translate all the signs. They have hardly anything in English. Sometimes the next town is in English or turn this way, but the stop signs and the no parking and all that, everything is it's Japanese, but it's different kind of signs, even their pictures. That's Kali Yuga. Anyway, niyama is the second thing. It comes after yama. When you can stop those things, then we can start doing something. So first is socham. That means purity or cleanliness. Satyam, socham, those are qualities of a spiritual person, of a brahmana. Satyam, truthfulness, cleanliness. That means keeping the body clean, clean clothes, take a bath, you know, a few times a day, keep clean clothes, you know, everything. Most people do that. Brush your teeth. But I heard he had one patient, right? He was always sick and he only took a bath every 3 days. He started taking every day and he got better. Because if you don't take a bath, then you sweat wrong. Can't detoxify. But also means purity of mind. Keeping the mind pure. Trying to think good thoughts. You know, think about doing good, and also you have to clean out the dirty things. That's why we chant mantras. Man means mind, and tra means deliverance. So they deliver the mind from the contamination or attachment and to, you know, temporary things. Because even if something is nice, but if it's temporary, it's not going to give us that much pleasure. Because you get it, you get all excited, and it's gone. And that's the body. Any pleasure that has anything to do with the body, only the body. We have to utilize our body to chant mantras and move around, but not that that's the source of all the pleasure. So keep clean. That means also eating, you know, purely. One in Africa, one television guy, he asked me, are you vegetarian? And I said, yeah, we believe in nonviolent eating. So he was like, oh, I never heard that before. Because most people don't connect that the meat eating is violent. You know, especially in these so-called civilized countries. Of course, here in Athens, we can see the meat market looks pretty violent. You know, at least you can see that there was some recent violence. But in America, I never saw that. Maybe in Chinatown, they tried to ban it. Everything's packaged up and frozen, and you know, in a nice display case. And, you know, it looks like very nice. You know, doesn't look like nobody knows where it's coming from. So, nonviolent eating. And clean eating, because otherwise it's violent to the body to eat things that are bad for it. To do things that are bad for the body, that's the violence. And there's santosha. Tosha means happiness. And san means complete. So one should seek that contentment and peacefulness. There's an interesting thing here, because if you do asanas, Iyengar, who's quite scientific in his asana teaching, and not just exercise, he's quite spiritual, says when you do the asanas, you make the blood fall over every cell, just like water, into turbines, and it generates and releases hidden energy and all these kind of things. So the more we can enliven like that, the more we can be happy. And mantra, like you see when you're chanting, everybody becomes quite happy one way or another. Because it brings us out from the, you know, day-to-day life and all the problems of life. They're all temporary anyway, and we're not these bodies. And all of us are going to have to leave the body at some point. So it's good to be aware of what we are and what's beyond this body, and that comes from hearing these mantras. So socham and these things can help one to be physically and mentally happy. Then there's tapas. This is a word that modern people don't like. You know what it means? Tapas. There's this, what are those tapa restaurants or something? I don't know what that is. It's not that. Because that means a heavy sense gratification. Right? Mm-hmm. But tapasya, tapa literally means heat. But it refers to austerity. voluntarily accepting some sort of suffering or inconvenience for the sake of a higher purpose. Like if someone wants to become a doctor, they may not go to as many parties as the other students do. They have to study much more. But then the result is they get big income and prestige and all the things like that. An athlete trying to get in the Olympics, they do great tapas. Their coaches pushing them in spite of the fact that, you know, every bone in their body is full of pain. But they do it again, work harder, harder. And they'll do it because they want whatever they think they're going to get. So yogis do tapasya also. Some of those tapasyas are just not good. They're not recommended by Krishna for spiritual progress. They just, like, they hold their hand up like this for 12 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stand on one leg, you know, for so long. Sleep standing up. They have to have a guru to do that, because the arm atrophies, and then to get it down, it takes a couple of years also. Something. But tapasya means the yamas are is a tapasya. To be celibate, to, you know, be truthful in Kali Yuga, these are tapasya. Giving up the, you know, sense gratification. That's a recommended tapasya. Then it cleans you out. Krishna says that he's not different from tapasya, proper kinds of tapasya. And there's tapasya that's in the mode of ignorance. That's those kind of things, you know, keeping their head buried for a week. Or yogis would go and stand in the ice water in the winter to meditate, so they would, you know, not be getting any sensual pleasure for their body. And they sit in the summer and they get little fire pots and they put all around them and they put on their head even, and they sit in the hot sun and they meditate. But those yogis usually smoke marijuana at night also. But that's their tapasya. But the tapasya, it should be for spiritual advancement, and those things are, there is a science of that, things in the mode of goodness. Karma yoga, doing good, you know, trying to always be good. So that most people, when they talk about austerity, you know, they don't like that idea. Monks in the Catholic Church, they used to wear what they called a hair shirt, scratchy, you know, so they wouldn't be comfortable. Right? And then some people think any kind of, you know, anything where you don't just do whatever you feel like doing, you don't gratify whatever desire you have immediately, that's some sort of horrible restriction on your freedom. But actually it gives you freedom when you're not. Like you have freedom to smoke Marlboro or smoke whatever else there is. In Greece it's quite a common thing, smoking. It's reduced, but the first time I came to Greece, I'd never in my life seen so many cigarette advertisements. And all of them were promoting great pleasure, a beautiful boy and girl, and just having a great time, Camel, and whatever it was. But then you're free to smoke. You can buy any, you know, everywhere. You don't have to move very far to buy cigarettes. But then you're not free to not smoke once you start, right? You're forced. You know, and people that smoke, I used to smoke, and I'm my friends like, why am I doing this? You know, yuck, ugh, ugh, this is horrible, you know. But you keep doing it. So that's not freedom at all. You're free to choose, change brands. And they try that, you know, get the low, whatever it is, you know, that's all the big, nobody knows what it is when it says low, mild. In Indonesia also there's so much smoking, and So they were pushing these mild, and then one came out and said, not mild, you know, for the tough guys. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. When it puts a warning on the pack, you know, well, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of cancer or death and all the things that might happen. But even if that doesn't happen, then you're just forced to, you know, to do that and spend your money. That's just one thing. So that's a very easy to understand example, but everything that's like that is the same thing. And so this so-called freedom, real freedom means you're not influenced by all these things. You can be peaceful without, you know, having to run off and smoke or run off and drink coffee, or you can wake up in the morning without coffee. Then there's Kriya Yoga, Swadhyaya, self-study, spiritual study. That's what we're doing here to some extent. Self means to understand the soul. And to understand the soul and think about the soul, that's why we have to, you know, reduce the meditation on the body, trying to satisfy the body all the time, because it can never be satisfied. To take care of it, because the soul, we live in the body, so we have to take care of the body. It's like if you're driving a car, you have to take care of it, right? Otherwise you can't drive it for very long. Even if you have a brand new car, but you never get it serviced, and at some point it will be finished. If you don't check the oil, and you don't check different things. So we have to take care of the body nicely, in the right way, so that we can use it to cultivate our spiritual study, to know the soul. But she was saying, like, you know, these mantras, if we really just can just get absorbed in hearing these mantras, we'll realize things will be revealed. You know, everything can be, if you could just chant this Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, all the time, everything would be revealed. Usually we can't do that. The last one is called Atma Nivedana, or Ishvara Pranidhana, offering one's life to God. So yoga really means, like I said, linking. The word means to link, to join. So ultimately the purpose is to link up with God. Then there's different understandings of God, but in the traditional yoga, the Supreme Being, like in every religion, the Father of everything, but much more than the Creator of everything. All those are just minor activities. The highest spiritual world is all about love, and all the relationships are with love. In America, a lot of Christians, they talk about God-fearing, you know. But a devotee of God doesn't have to be afraid of God. God is afraid. Demons are afraid. Sinful people, just like a criminal is afraid of the law, but a law-abiding citizen is not afraid when he sees a policeman. But a criminal, they always start getting worried why that policeman is up near me. And they're afraid. They always have to be looking out. But an honest person doesn't have to be afraid of law. So, anyway, Atma Nivedana. Atma means the soul. Giving everything for spiritual life. Giving everything. The body ultimately doesn't belong to us, even though we're in it. And we have proprietorship. Ultimately, you know, when you're a child, it belongs to your parents, and then it belongs to maybe your employer or the country. Maybe in many countries they can just put you into the army, you can't say anything, right? And ultimately it belongs to, when you leave the body, you don't have anything to say about what they do with it. A different culture, whatever you come from, they do something with it. So it'll become worms. If you bury it, worms will eat it. If you burn it, it becomes ashes. some countries they just leave it out and the animals eat it and it becomes animal remnants. And it's not ours, but we have it, it's been given to us, so we need to take care of it and utilize it for a good higher purpose. If we just utilize it for, you know, trying to satisfy every desire that it has, then we'll just get waste of human life. Human life is special. That these things are for humans. And then comes asan in yoga. That means postures, because that makes the body healthy and that able to sit for some time and maybe be satisfied. Then pranayama, breathing, controlling the breathing. Then we can meditate properly, because everybody's breathing. If you are deprived of eating, you can live for quite some time before you die. Some people never eat, they just breathe, and they don't have to ever eat. They live very long then. If you don't get water, it's a shorter time that you can't live. And if you don't get air, how long can you live? If you don't breathe, right? If your breathing is stopped, then very quickly you finish. But we breathe, I think, something like 30,000 times a day. But most of us, we don't pay any attention to the breathing. It just goes on. And so some people are, you know, if you hear them at night, even in the daytime, you know. So they become very unhealthy because of that. But in the yoga, Buddhism, meditation, always the first thing is conscious breathing, you know, breathe in, breathe out. Just meditate on it. Be conscious that this is what's keeping your body going. If you see, I've seen some of these science movies they give in the schools now. You know, all the things that happen when you breathe and how the air gets, you know, through your lungs and into your blood, and then it goes everywhere, and then it goes around, and it gets all depleted, and it comes back and gets charged up again, the blood, from more air. So when you breathe properly, and there's many different pranayama, and they're very important. And actually chanting japa is a type of pranayama too, because you breathe in, and then you're breathing in so that you can say the mantras, and so when you're breathing out, you're saying, on the out-breath, you're saying the mantras. So that's like perfect use of the breath. But it's, you know, it's just think about it every once in a while, that you're breathing. You know, it's not just an ordinary thing. It's something most important for maintaining the body. Most important. The air nourishes the body and the mind. The food, only the body. And the water, also only the body. But the air is much more subtle, and it nourishes the body and the mind. That's why we like to go to the forest or the seaside, where there's a lot of prana in the air. The air is much different than if you're in a traffic jam. Then you want to hold your breath, right? But, you know, sometimes you just feel like you don't want to breathe. Or I saw a picture of the riot, you know, and they had the gas mask on and stuff because the police had thrown. But it's almost like that. And I was just in Nigeria, and in the traffic jam there, it might as well be tear gas. There's so much, you know, cars blowing dark black smoke, and there's no wind. You can hardly breathe. That air is dead. And people don't, they come depressed, angry, unhealthy. So we want to get up in the mountain or something. In modern science, they call it negative ions. That's the definition of prana. When the air has a lot of negative ions in it, it's good for you. Positive ions are not good. That's what air conditioners produce, that all the pollution is full of positive ion. So now in Japan, they have so many things that are supposed to be ions, you know, bracelets and necklaces. And, you know, people try everything. But there are air filters that are ionized. Even they have an air conditioner now that's an ionizer. They know that, you know, there's something. But that, and when we get in a nice place, we want to, you know, really breathe. And that's why when people are jogging or something and they breathe really deep, they feel really good. Right? They get like intoxicated. They get a lot of energy when they start to breathe deeper and get more flowing. And it also gets the dirt out. You know, when you breathe out. So then yoga, you know, you breathe out is very important also for pranayama. So that way we can utilize this human life and easily follow these yamas and niyamas and then come to the highest stage of samadhi, which can become complete absorption in the soul and the spiritual connection and living in the spiritual world. And can't jump to any of that, but this age is very liberal, so these mantras, they can help us to progress much faster. But if one is chanting the mantras, you know, doing some kind of spiritual meditation, but then not following the yamas and niyamas, you won't get very far. So many people, they practice these things and think, well, it didn't work. And even in many religions, although those things are there, you know, people promote, you don't have to worry about anything, just do this, just call Jesus or something, he'll take care of everything. He'll take care of everything if you do everything, and then he'll help you. So the Krishna will help if we just practice. It's very easy. Nonviolence is, of course, nonviolent thinking is takes some effort. Because we're very conditioned to getting angry and, you know, thinking of, you know, do something. But even if we just start with nonviolent eating and, you know, and of course nowadays even the farming is very violent, you know, everything is violent. The amount of trees that are cut down every day is like inconceivable. You know, they just burn things and to grow soybeans to feed pigs, you know. So it's a very violent time. Most of the movies are just violent. It's a symptom of the mode of ignorance, darkness, you know, violence. People are living on violent from eating or meditating on all these violent things, and then they're rioting and doing all kinds of things. And saying they want peace. To start, become peaceful. Alright? That alright? Hope I didn't offend anybody. But this is a very simple thing, and it's just basic. You can find it on the internet. If you look it up, there's many, many references. Different explanations of the benefits of doing these things and the, you know, the defects of not doing them, which is quite obvious. You just think about it a little bit, anybody can see. Okay, is that it?
Thank you.
Do we stop there and chant more?
Yeah.
Because I see everybody really like chanting. That's the most important thing, you know, is the chanting and just giving everything to. Forget everything else and just let it enter through the ear. Can go into the heart. Becoming a circulation coming out, going in, coming out. How do you stop? What other people do we have in other countries that represent?